Welcome to our show. Welcome to the Institute Library on Chapel Street in New Haven. I mean, you're not actually there, and we're here in kind of an intimate little setting here. We wanted to go to the Institute Library for this amazing show because the Institute Library is this just remarkable history-drenched facility in New Haven. We hope you come down here sometime and discover it, as we have. We're going to tell you a story today that goes back 45 years. For a few days in May, New Haven was, I think it's fair to say, the center of world attention, although there was a lot going on in the world at the moment, even a lot going on in America at the moment. But for maybe a couple of days, people really had their eyes on New Haven. Two members of the Black Panther Party were on trial for their roles in a terrible murder. The city became a target for protests, culminating in the so-called May Day rallies. The students on campus included future leaders like Kurt Schmoke, who became a mayor of Baltimore, somebody named Hillary Rodham, ever heard of her, Henry Louis Gates. And then the list of proverbial outside agitators was kind of a who's who of outside agitators for the time, including Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden, Allen Ginsberg. Because Allen Ginsberg isn't really an agitator. He's an outside ohm-sayer or something. He actually was de-agitating people. And then the list of late 20th century historical figures who somehow passed through this story includes Cyrus Vance, Archibald Cox, John Hersey, John Dean. John Dean was here in the city watching things on behalf of President Nixon, seeing if anything would require special John Dean attention, whatever that amounted to at the time. It's also a story about what could have happened and what was avoided thanks to some cool heads on the scene. One of those cool heads is here with us today as part of our panel. Let me tell you who's here. The cool head would belong to Henry, otherwise known as Sam Chauncey, who graduated from Yale. I won't say when you graduated from Yale, but he worked for Yale in many capacities. His main job was the coach of the Davenport hockey team, but occasionally, just to flesh that out those hours a little bit, he was secretary of the university and many other things besides. And he is the author, newly, of May Day at Yale, 1970, Recollections, The Trial of Bobby Seale and the Black Panthers, has a foreword by Henry Louis Gates, has amazing photos. Also with me is author Paul Bass, editor and reporter and founder of the New Haven Independent. He's the author of Murder in the Model City. I'm holding my copy of it right here in my hand. Also with us, Alex Bragg. Are you on the board here at the library, the Institute?
No, I'm not. I'm just a member.
Just a member. Member of the Institute Library, and one of the people living in New Haven at the time, one of the young men kind of caught up in the drama of this time. So I guess I'm going to begin, Alex, by just asking you to remember New Haven, not on May Day, but on an average day in 1969 or 1970. During this period, did New Haven feel like a city that was perched on the edge of something? Was there a kind of tension, a mood that doesn't exist now that existed then?
Well, at the time, prior to the May Day situation, it was a hippie era. Mm. And you would see people dressed in colorful clothes, young people, right? But it was, I didn't sense a lot of tension. There may have been a lot of underlying tension because all the things that were going on in the world at large. You know, we had B-52s flying around 24 hours a day. It was middle of the Cold War. But it was rather quiet at the time. And then things start to escalate as time went on. And, you know, New Haven, the green was peaceful. There was no aggressive panhandling at the time. There was no gun violence at the time, as I recall. I wasn't out and about as much then because I had just became a supervisor at the hospital for about 4 or 5 years earlier. So it was pretty calm and quiet then.
How visible were the Black Panthers generally? They were running meal programs in various places. Oh. And I mean, were you, as a citizen of New Haven, aware of the Black Panthers?
No, I would see them on the street. They had breakfast programs going on at the time. The Black Panthers were out and about all the time, you know, meeting and greeting people. I didn't sense all that much militancy about them, the ones I met anyway. You know, they seemed pretty rational people.
Well, and actually, Paul, that sort of even gets into some of what's in your book. Is there, in some ways, I almost feel reading your book that there were two Black Panther units in New Haven. One is the one that Alex is describing, and then there was the group that ultimately became involved in this criminal case.
Yeah, and there wasn't the Black Panther Party. It's almost as though New Haven accidentally became the stage for this drama. Because he said there weren't very many members here. This all began with the murder, interrogation and murder of a suspected spy within the Panther ranks. He wasn't from New Haven. He was brought up from New York for discipline. It turns out he was one of the few people in New Haven who were not spies, tragically. And it just, they commandeered the Panthers had only been here 6 months before that trial execution took place in 1969. And the only reason they were here was an accident, which was there was a man from New Haven named John Huggins who had gone out to Oakland, who was a Panther leader. He was murdered in a shootout between rival black nationalist groups, the guy who founded Kwanzaa. So his widow, Erica Huggins, brought his body back here to St. Luke's Church, sort of a bastion of middle-class black New Haven, to be buried. She stayed here. She recruited a few people, Warren Kimbrough, George Edwards, a few others. But this all happened because a crew came up from New York after a big bust in New York to try to weed out informers. They dragged this semi-literate guy from Florida named Alex Rackley here, put him in the basement of Warren Kimbrough's apartment in a co-op called Ethan Gardens, poured boiling water over him, got a fake confession, tied him in a bed for 4 days in his own feces and everything, and then took him out to be killed. And because the FBI and the Black Panthers were at war, when he was killed, they immediately arrested the person who shot him and the person who ordered him to shoot him, and they both confessed. But the FBI tried to also get the national leadership, and they put a trial here in New Haven, and that caused great protests. And soon, everything about the Black Panther Party seen here was about freeing Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins, who were the defendants. With a death, the government was seeing the death penalty, and in Bobby Seale's case, there really was not an iota evidence that he had anything to do with it. Huggins' role was a little more murky, but it certainly wasn't a capital offense, and that's how the Black Panther story came to New Haven.
Sam Chauncey, how soon did you, and you were working as the young assistant for Kingman Brewster, how soon did you and Kingman Brewster know that this story was going to spill over onto Yale as an institution?
We first knew, I'm going to say, about March 15th. It was about 6 weeks before the May Day date. And my recollection is, and Paul may remember better than I do, but it probably occurred because of the indictment of Seale. That is, people began to get excited about Bobby Seale being indicted as opposed to the individuals who had actually confessed to the murder. And so we had about 6 weeks in which we could plan ahead and get ready for this event.
Maybe now is the time then to tell the story of the Cornish hen and the martinis in the hamper that went up to Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
Well, we had looked at what had happened at other universities that had riots and disruptions, and none of them seemed to be able to manage it very well, and there were bloodied heads and burned buildings and so on. So we did turn to a man named Archibald Cox, who later became quite famous as Solicitor General. And Archie Cox had the same job at Harvard that I had at Yale. He was a kind of assistant to President Pusey. And we knew him, and so we wanted to find out what he knew, in particular whether he could give us some leads on some of the radical leadership that were in the Boston area. So we met. We decided to have a secret meeting with him, and as I recall, it was in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, somewhere near Old Sturbridge Village, and we did. Mrs. Brewster packed a very elegant picnic, and we went and met in a field, and Archibald Cox was very helpful to us and gave us pictures of some of the radicals that we were, so we could identify the people coming in from out of town. But that was one of the many contacts we made, which convinced us that we had to have a different strategy, that we were not going to throw police and so on at protesters, that we had to find some way to neutralize the radicals who were not just bent on destruction but who really cared about issues of importance of the time. And that's what convinced us that instead of locking down the Yale campus, we were going to open it up.
Mm-hmm. Paul, how did it come to be that there was going to be this one weekend where like every famous radical in America showed up?
It was the white radicals who called it the Yippies.
Yeah,
and they, Sam was referencing what happened in Harvard when they had a march, and it was about the New Haven trial.
Mm-hmm.
It was in support of New Haven trial. And they were so incensed that the gates were slammed that they went rampaging in riots, breaking windows, attacking cops. People went to the hospital. And that's what Sam and his crew were reacting to. So then it came to be that we're just going to shut down Yale on May Day. You know, May Day has the history of the workers' holiday, and they're supposed to be. And they didn't know that that was going to be the day after President Nixon announced that we were invading Cambodia. But bombing Cambodia. But that was a different question. But so that's how New Haven got to be the focal point. We're going to pick a day, and we're going to come shut down New Haven. Then became burned down Yale. I think they forgot that the buildings were made of stone, but you know, it sounded good. Yeah. You know, the yippies, and that was how it got to be New Haven.
Alex, you were out on the green, and you know, you were saying earlier that this was sort of the era of flower power, and there were, you know, there'd be happenings and events and things like that on the green. This day was different, though, right? I mean, did you know right away this is going to go a little differently?
Well, all my history in New Haven, I've never seen that many people ever on the green.
Yeah.
I remember my earliest years in New Haven when Glenn Miller's orchestra would be on the green. That was close, but not even close to that. But it was packed.
They didn't need the people. National Guard for Glenn Miller.
No, they it was really packed with people. And I remember the irony, the thing that amused me most was, I guess the FBI, they were present, but I think they were the older generation, and they had not made the switch to the cultural change yet.
Mm-hmm.
And with the hippies and yippies, and they tried to disguise themselves. It was always something to tip you off to them, and it made you laugh because the haircuts weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what else, whatever garb they had on, you look down and they would have like wingtip shoes. And everybody knew who they were, but they thought they were blending in, but they weren't. You know, they just couldn't adapt to this time of rapid change. I guess they were harkened back to the 50s at a quieter time.
You know, Sam, a lot of people were pretending to be things that they weren't necessarily at the time. And I think in Paul's book, there's an account of a meeting in Kingman Brewster's office where a lot of the people who are going to wind up leading these rallies, Tom Hayden and Jerry Rubin and all these people are there. People who are going to be out there on the green, in the case of Jerry Rubin, yelling, you know, F Kingman Brewster, you know. But everybody's kind of nice at the meeting, right?
Well, yes. The meeting, actually, it was at 3 a.m. on May Day before the day began, and it was in Kingman Brewster's house. And they were all there, and we were there. And the purpose of the meeting was to see if we could come to an understanding about how each side would sort of behave themselves. And we reached an understanding, and I vividly remember Jerry Rubin, as he was leaving the house maybe an hour and a half later, putting his arms around, giving Kingman Brewster a big hug and saying, "Oh, Kingman, you're such a wonderful person. This is so great." And then 5 or 6 hours later, he was standing there saying, "Effing Kingsley Brewer,"
that's right,
on the green. So that was the rhetoric of the moment, and we'd learned not to pay much attention to the rhetoric.
Paul, the way that you described it in your book, too, about maybe about 15,000 people in the city, less than had been anticipated in the most catastrophic or, depending on how you want to look at it, or optimistic estimates. And the way that you describe it is that if there's 15,000 people, there's 14,000 people who are basically, you know, no more violent than Alex Bragg. And then there's 1,000 that have something else on their minds.
Right. And they're anticipating 100,000 originally. And that's what the gear up was for. Right. And I think what happened was that, I don't know if this is jumping ahead of the story, Colin, but the speeches took place. Everything was fine. It really, Yale opened the gates, and all the radicals were sleeping there for free and being fed Gorp for breakfast. And they were having speeches at night. And there really was a conspiracy going on, which was great, because it was a period of conspiracies, most of which weren't true, while other conspiracies were going on. Not only were Sam and Kingsley Brewster, King Brewster meeting with Rubin et al., but the Panthers were part of the conspiracy, and so were the cops who were wiretapping them. They were all convinced that there was a plot for there to be violence, but it was the right wing.
Yeah.
They believed Nixon wanted a campus to blow, which did happen 4 days later at Kent State. The National Guard had orders they could not be disciplined if they shot somebody. And so that even though they were all effing each other or secretly thwarting each other and wiretapping each other, Bobby Seale recorded from jail a message urging people not to be violent. Mm. And the Panthers actually rode around in a car blasting that message. But as you mentioned, there were some white radicals who wanted, and the Black Coalition in town, which was a sort of more mainstream liberal group, they were in the neighborhoods urging people not even to come downtown. They're worried, say, when you white radicals leave, we're going to be living with the outcome of this violence. Mm. But there was this feeling that there was going to be some kind of tense violence. And there were these 1,000 or so people who, white, not from New Haven mostly, who after the rally was over the first day, someone who was not a Panther but pretended to be rushed into a courtyard at Yale, said they're beating up and arresting a Panther in the green. They came and confronted the police. Everything clicked into gear. The Bobby Seale tape was played. Sam had his bank of telephones and everyone on notice about making sure gates are open. And then they started pelting the cops with bottles and rocks, and there was a confrontation, and the cops didn't shoot, but they set off tear gas, and downtown got to be tear gas, and everyone rushed toward the old campus where Allen Ginsberg was chanting Ohm mm-hmm. on a stage. I wish he had read his poem. He wrote a great poem about May Day being here. But Sam, I don't want to steal your thunder. Do you want to say what happened when the tear gas went off? You sure?
Well, this
is a great moment.
It was a great moment because I thought I was the master planner. And our headquarters was a little building just off the green, but where you could see the green, but it wasn't actually on the green. And we had all kinds of equipment and telephones and everything, and I anticipated it was going to be warm and that we might have tear gas, so I installed air conditioning units in all the windows. And it was very warm that day, and we turned the air conditioning on, but I forgot that you have to make an adjustment to keep the outside air from coming in. So it turned out that we gassed ourselves in the building, and we were all walking around with tears streaming down our face because the tear gas had came in.
But the big thing was that they ran to the gates as planned. Mm-hmm. So all the organizers, Sam's people, the Panthers, the cops, all cooperating against who they thought were the Nixon enemy, they said, okay, everybody go to the green. But then someone started closing the gate.
Yeah.
Which was the making of a disaster.
In other words, after all of this planning, all this careful planning that the Phelps Gate, which is the gate from College Street into the old campus, would be kept open and as a kind of a release valve, really, from all this. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and its weakest link was whoever didn't get that memo, right?
Well, whoever didn't get the memo had the orders reversed, and we did. In the end, I think we opened the gate.
You hopped on the phone.
I got on the phone.
You got the message, and they kept it open.
We opened the gate back up again.
So, Alex, did you get gassed?
Oh, yes. And this is how it happened. I was the evening shift supervisor in the respiratory care department in St. Rayfield's Hospital. Now, at the time, I worked with this young man named Richard Lilly. He was from Coos Bay, Oregon. Very gregarious, redheaded kid. And so he got this idea, we're going to get off at 11:30 hours. Why don't we just go downtown and see what's going on downtown? I says, okay. I remember not wanting to take my car because it was relatively new, so we walked from the hospital to the corner of College and Chapel. Now, I don't know how it got started, but it got kind of rowdy there. And all of a sudden, he said, we have to be prepared. Wet a handkerchief or something, a towel, and put it over your face because it might be tear gas. Surely enough, it was. I don't know what started off. I know it seemed to me I didn't see too many black people in evidence at that time. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be young, quasi-young Caucasian kids, but I don't think they were from the area, really. I think they were outside. Word that was outside agitators or something. But I got tear gassed, tears running, nose running. And then I said, why did I let him talk me into coming here? So I beat a hasty retreat and went home where I should have gone in the first place. But it was really chaotic because right on the corner, the ground zero of it seemed to be on the corner of Chapel and College Street and going down toward the gate on College Street. There was a rush of bodies when it happened. And they seem to be going in all that direction.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're live from the Institute Library in New Haven. Well, we're not live, actually. You'll be hearing this in a week or two from the beautiful sunny day when we're recording this. We'll be back in just a minute.
The home of the the free, the land of the brave, where fear and frustration dance on your grave, where martial law blows in the breeze, with basketball plays and the greatest of ease. No more health care, no more dreams, no more heroes, no more themes. College education at a minimum wage, looking at the future and then turning the page. Homeless and shelter.
We're back. We're here at the Institute Library in New Haven. We wanted to be in New Haven for this conversation. We're on Chapel Street, not too far from where Alex Bragg, one of our guests, got gassed. And he's here with us. He's a member here of the Institute Library. And he was a young man living in New Haven during the time of the Black Panther trial and the unrest that surrounded it. Paul Bass is with us, editor, reporter, founder of New Haven Independent, author of the book Murder in the Model City, the story of this time. Henry, otherwise known as Sam Chauncey, is here with us, the former secretary of Yale University, and many other things as well, and the author most recently of May Day at Yale, 1970, Recollections, the Trial of Bobby Seale and the Black Panthers. And by the way, I'm just so you don't think that we're too male-oriented, we had a woman guest all lined up today, and she, at the last minute, couldn't make it. But we wanted to have the voice of a woman in all of this. So I want to backtrack a little bit from the events of May Day that we just covered, and also talk a little bit about, I guess, maybe sort of some of the philosophical conversations leading up to it. And Sam, I want to begin with the fact that your boss, Kingman Brewster, at the time, made a rather remarkable statement, I think, at Sprague Hall, one that kind of thrust him into the national conversation in the way that he hadn't been before. Not talking about the unrest so much, but about the trial of Bobby Seale and what it meant to him, and whether he thought a black man could get a fair trial in America at that time. Tell us about that and kind of what happened as a result.
Well, just prior to the remarks he made, which was in a speech he gave to the Yale faculty, some things had gone on in the courtroom. I'm at a loss to give you the exact details, but some things had occurred where people were found in contempt of court and so on for rather strange reasons. And Brewster himself was a lawyer, had been trained as a lawyer and been a professor in the Harvard Law School before he came to Yale. And he really was concerned. And the phrase he used was very specific. He said that he was sad or worried that he found he was skeptical about whether a person could get a fair trial, a black person could get a fair trial. We knew that sentence was in the speech. We knew it might be picked up, but he insisted on it because, as a lawyer, it troubled him. It really bothered him. Well, the speech did get out, and it absolutely exploded, and the most prominent person to comment on it was Vice President Agnew, who immediately called for Brewster's resignation or firing or something like that. But the truth of the matter was that in this period, and as we were preparing for May Day, it became increasingly clear to us, as Paul has mentioned, that the right wing was at work here, and that we subsequently learned that President Nixon did kind of want one of the elite universities to blow up because he thought it might bring the center of the country more to the right in time for the next election. We knew that J. Edgar Hoover was, with a lot of other people, tapping phones, and that the FBI was sort of in this. And we became concerned about the environment in which all of this was going on, because it wasn't the radicals who scared us the most at sometimes, but the right wing. But nevertheless, there was a lot of tension. And really the reason my two colleagues, the two photographers, John Hill and Tom Strong, brought out this book was because there is good history about May Day. Paul's book and another book by a man named John Taft give the facts beautifully. But a lot of people kept asking me, what did it feel like? What was the sense of people's tension and fear and so on? And so we've tried to capture what it felt like through pictures primarily. There's some text in the book, but mm-hmm. The idea is that these pictures will show you what it felt like to see all of Broadway boarded up.
Mm-hmm.
And a town that, as Alex has said, was doing okay. all of a sudden becoming a place of fear.
The response, Sam, that came from Spiro Agnew and other commentators on the right, it kind of thrust Kingman Brewster into a role that I don't, maybe you wouldn't have guessed that he would wind up inhabiting. I mean, he became kind of a placeholder or symbolic of left-wing college president, right? And that, in a way, I don't know, I was here when he was president. That's not who he seemed to be on an average day.
No. Well, one of the great tensions in his presidency was the issue that any college president faces, and that is, to what degree does a college president make speeches about public issues? And Kingman had always made the point that the only time that he would speak out on a national issue was when he thought that issue would affect the students or the university itself. And so he did speak out ultimately about the war in Vietnam because it was affecting the students because of the draft and so on. But I don't think he wanted to be a great public spokesman. He never wanted to run for political office, but he was a person who, when he felt he had to speak out, could be very articulate and could be very strong.
And Paul, you know, in your book, you know, it's intriguing, I think, the way that this case became something other than what the case started out to be. I mean, in some ways, if you look at the facts of the murder case, the murder of Alex Rackley, it's kind of cut and dried. I mean, we know who pulled the trigger. We know who made Warren Kimbrough pull the trigger, this guy George Sams. There aren't that many mysteries about it. If it had ever been handled that way, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation today. In a way, this is a conversation more about a kind of cynicism and manipulation of this case that went on both at maybe at the city level and at the national level.
I believe that it was misused by both sides, really. Hmm. I mean, Warren Kimbrough, who committed the murder, he used to say he couldn't believe people called them heroes because everyone forgot that the Black Panthers, which were founded to stop police violence, deadly police violence against African-Americans, tortured and killed an innocent African-American. I mean, and they're called heroes for that. And on the other hand, the J. Edgar Hoover and FBI had a program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, which later, according to hearings by the Frank Church's committee, so that they committed vast crimes and violating people's rights, they were out to destroy this organization. Mm-hmm. And they saw this murder as a way, again, to change the facts in order to take down the leadership of the organization, which is what I believe the was all about in the prosecution of this case. And also the prosecutor here in New Haven named Arnold Markle was a very sincere liberal. Mm-hmm. And he believed very much that these were the wrong kinds of African-Americans and that they were really misusing their own community. So he was going to be the savior to really knock off the top guys, and he was a true believer on that. So you're right, there were a lot of agendas. And I also think the Kingman-Brewster agenda was a little different, too. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing it today in the fight over the Republican Party, which Brewster's side lost. He came out of that Patricia New England Republican Party that founded the Civil Liberties Union. And he wanted to make Yale a meritocracy. He opened it up for the first time to many African-American students. This was the first class there then with Skip Gates, Henry Gates, who writes in that. He writes a beautiful piece in Sam's book and elsewhere about what it felt like to be caught between this first group brought here and what the responsibilities try to succeed there, and yet being also called out by African-Americans on the street that you're not being genuine. So there were these other agendas going on, as you say, that made May Day a flashpoint.
Yeah, you get the feeling. Were you going to say something, Sam?
Well, yeah. There's a wonderful picture in the book with people protesting with banners and placards and so on, and we tried to count, and there's something like 10 different protests going on. And we point out in the book that, you know, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the gay movement, I believe the assassinations of Jack Kennedy, Martin King, and Bobby Kennedy devastated people who saw change coming and then it didn't come. And so I think the agendas in this weekend were many, and one of the things that's interesting to me is that it's the last really big rally of this era, the really big, where all those leaders were here and everything. So people were sort of coming together to see if they couldn't keep all this stuff going, and then I think the Kent State shootings really took the steam out of a lot of a lot of people's feelings. I mean, there were other events that occurred afterwards, but I think there were all kinds of agendas.
I wonder, I'm going to ask all of you about this. One of the perceptions that you get about this was that this is a moment where there was the potential for something much more terrible to happen. And the Panthers were kind of telling two different stories. In some of their public pronouncements, they were saying, kill the pigs, burn the university. In other ways, they were playing much more conciliatory roles behind the scenes. And then you had a lot of people there, you know, comes some of the people Alex talks about, kind of unfocused young white people from God knows where, here for God knows what reason, and other genuine radicals. And a lot of careful planning going on behind the scenes by Sam Chauncey and Kingman Brewster and a lot of people. But the stage was set for something much worse to happen. And what you did, you had tear gas, you had a little bit of blood spilled that day, but
and
I mean,
bombing.
Well, we'll get to the bombing in just a second. Paul really wants us to get to that bombing. Boy, if you wanted to strike fear to the heart of Sam Chauncey, bomb a hockey rink. Anyway, we'll come to that in a second. But I mean, I'm just wondering how close you feel that day came or that weekend came to being the thing that everybody feared. Like, I know Alex, you know, you very wisely went home after getting gassed. But did it feel to you, and did people in New Haven feel as though this really could tilt into something considerably worse in the form of a riot or chaos or, you know, bloodshed?
It was a double, to my view, it was a double-edged sword. Mm. There was a sense of impending doom, but on the other hand, there was a sense of hopefulness for positive change leading into the future.
Yeah.
And those two opposite things were rubbing up against each other. Mm. And even amidst the chaos, as I was talking to Sam about, on New Haven Green, there was a sense of camaraderie, because you never saw that many people from different economic backgrounds and social strata conversing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Black, white, doesn't matter what, Native or Native Americans out there. And as Sam said, everyone had a different agenda. When you could, as when I saw his book, the pictures, it brought it all back in vivid detail. Mm-hmm. The boarded up stores and the placards. Everybody, there were multiple agendas going on.
Colin, I think in answer to your question, we came very close. And I think one of the people who deserves an enormous amount of credit was the New Haven police chief, Jim Ahern, who was way, way ahead of his time in understanding crowd control and police tactics, and who had been put in charge by the federal, state, and local authorities of all of the sort of manpower in the city. And history told us then, and history tells us now, that when a little event explodes, it sometimes sets off the whole powder keg. Mm-hmm. We never had a really little event that exploded and began to escalate. So I think we came close, but we were darn lucky, among others, to have someone like Ahern who was so careful about the use of police force and in keeping and just isolating incidents. I remember there was some two or three young white kids who were trying to maybe break into a store or something, and he was able to get some plainclothes policemen to just whisk them out of the way so that nothing would set off the big bomb.
And I think also a lot of it is, I mean, this remarkable story of opening the campus up to people. I mean, some of the rhetoric that preceded it was burn this place down, or, you know, rise up, Yale students. And I mean, it was a remarkable decision to say, oh, no, come on in and sleep in the courtyards, and we'll give you granola for breakfast. And I mean, it just that has a way of putting the pin back in the grenade.
And you know, in a way, we had no choice, because the alternative was for the place to get bashed and beaten down. But the idea that by welcoming the radicals from out of town into the campus, it scared the daylights out of us, but it turned out to be harmless.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break. We're going to come back. We're live here. We're not live. We're taping here at the Institute Library. We feel very much alive, though. And we'll take a break. We'll come back after this.
Yes, my skin is black, but that's no reason to hold me back.
Why don't you think about it? Today's show was produced by Katie Tularski and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our intern is Sydney Lauro. For show pages, photos, and articles, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, we look back at the week with our pop culture roundtable, The Nose. Now, back to Colin.
We're back. We're here at the Institute Library on Chapel Street in New Haven, not too far from where the dramatic events of May Day of 1970 unfolded. With us, Paul Bass, a founder, editor, reporter for the New Haven Independent, the author of Murder in the Model City, one of the books written about those days. Alex Bragg is with us. He's a member here of the Institute Library. I'm going to be working on a book called The Alex Bragg Guide to Youthful Living. Are you 75?
74.
You're 74? This guy, 9th. He comes like bounding up the stairs today. He's like, I'm dragging my 60-year-old carcass in here. I want to walk the way you walk. I'm 60 years old and you're walking better than I am. You've got a spring in your step. Well, I don't know what you're doing. But
it's just genetic.
Yeah, no, don't say that. We need to put out a book that makes people think that they can. Don't say that genetic thing ever again. That costs us money every time you say that, Alex. All right, and Sam Chauncey is here with us. He was the secretary of the university. He was an assistant to Kingman Brewster at the time of the unrest here in New Haven. His new book is May Day at Yale, 1970, Recollections, The Trial of Bobby Seale, and The Black Panthers. As Sam points out, there's just incredible photography in here and an essay by Henry Louis Gates and all kinds of stuff. So we're kind of heading down the home stretch here. All right, so Paul... after things appeared to die down.
I'm embarrassed now. Okay.
No. Well, actually, we haven't really said, and this is the way that you describe it. I don't know if it fits with the way Sam and Alex remember it, but there were supposed to be 3 days, and at the end of 2 days, it was like people just
thought.
And
the second day was a dud.
Yeah, the second day was not much.
Nothing was going on the second day. They just canceled day three, but the action was moving because of the war in now moving to Cambodia.
Yeah, so suddenly there were hotter protest spots. Yeah.
The Panthers got eclipsed on May 2nd.
Yeah. But then there was an explosion.
Well, May 1st, we were previously talking about that first day they had the rallies. Mm. The first night, the false report sends people to the green where there's a complex of cops and the tear gas. There was also a rock concert at Ingalls Rink with 2 stages. And Sam, correct me if I'm wrong in recollection, the band finished on one of the stages and packed up. And when people moved to the other side of the rink, a bomb went off that was so powerful it busted the roof, blew out the windows, and destroyed the stage. And miraculously, nobody got hurt. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. And all the people there were the radicals. That is, we had allowed the rink to be used by the radicals to have this dance rock concert. And so the fact that the rink was blown up perplexed everybody because why would one of the radicals bomb the radicals? Mm-hmm. There had also been a fire in one of the radicals' sort of office space. I think it was called the Peace Building.
The New Politics Corner.
New Politics Corner. And we wondered why the radicals would arson their own building.
Mm-hmm.
We have suspicions. We knew Jim Ahern was... quietly photographing as many people, sort of checking into hotels and motels in the area. And he called to my attention one day that a man named John Dean had come in. And John Dean at that time did not work for President Nixon. He worked for Attorney General Mitchell. He was his personal assistant. And that was all the more curious because this man registered under an assumed name. And also... the Attorney General had sent an assistant Attorney General to be present in New Haven, and we all knew who he was, and he was a cooperative and helpful man. So one wonders whether Mr. Dean had any role in this, because who else but a right-winger would be likely to have set off that bomb in the rink or to have... had something to do with arson in the New Politics Building. The piece of planning that saved us with the rink was that one of the things Cyrus Vance had told me was that we should have immediate connection with all the news media. And if something went wrong that sounded like it could escalate into something bigger, the theory was you got on the horn to the news media and said, well, there's been a bomb in the rink, but it's not a problem and nobody's been hurt. even though on the police radio they were calling for ambulances by the dozens because they had assumed a lot of people were hurt. But it never escalated. We never solved where that bomb came from. It almost required tearing down the rink, but they were able to salvage it and repair it, so it's still there today. But it's still a mystery to me as to how that happened.
Mm. Alex, were you going to say something about that?
I really appreciate what I've learned here from Sam about what happened at a time and how close we came to total chaos in that situation. Cooler heads, because of what was going on with Yale's participation, his participation, he was part of that. I was always wondering at the time, somebody must be behind the scenes keeping the lid on this. But I wasn't sure who it was. I said,
"This it's that guy."
I know. Now I know who it is. It's Sam. It was Sam and his minions.
Although I have to tell one of my favorite stories from Paul's book, because Sam just mentioned Cyrus Vance. And so Cyrus Vance, for people who didn't know, maybe the greatest American diplomat of certainly the second half of the 20th century, and one of the many people that Sam and Kingman Brewster could turn to for advice. And there's this one great scene in Paul's book where Sam brings Cyrus Vance into this operations center where he's got these 20 phones set up and for all the emergencies that are going to come up. And Cyrus Vance looks at them and goes, I want to hear one of those phones ring. And so Sam has a secretary or somebody call one of the phones, and they're sitting there looking at the 20 phones with no idea which one of them's ringing. And Sam says, all right, the phone's got to have lights on them. It's those little things, you know, those little things.
Details.
One of the questions that I have is sort of about we get through this, we get through May Day, we get through the rallies, the outside agitators move on to agitate someplace else. I struggled to understand sort of what New Haven was like after that. I mean, it seems as though things calmed down pretty quickly and the city kind of went back to what it had always been. But, I mean, Alex, maybe I'll start with you. I mean, is that how it felt?
Because the gradual crescendo leading up to May Day and shortly thereafter was so intense, the air was so electrified with so many things going on, I think New Haven went into a state of exhaustion. You know, what goes up has to come down, and I think we were just exhausted and needed a break. So things just died down of their own accord because of the fatigue, psychological fatigue of it all.
Sam, I arrived at Yale in 1972. Shortly after that, President Brewster decried my class or my generation at Yale as an era of grim professionalism, that's what he called it. And I mean, I sort of feel like he thought we were kind of boring, you know, compared to what he'd been through in the past.
Well, you know, I agree with him. You were kind of boring. But it's an interesting question jumping forward to today, because I have an occasion to talk to Yale students today, and that's 45 years later. And it's pretty hard to find a student that's very passionate about anything. It's not common, and I think there was a wonderful side to what was going on in New Haven until May Day, and that was the liveliness of people's interest in change. And if you go back and you think of all the radical proposals that were running around this city on that weekend for change, today most of those are the gospel. The things that people were trying to change are things that we now take totally for granted, which always gives me now cause when I hear a radical idea today to be very cautious about jumping on it, because, you know, that may be the gospel of tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Although, Paul, on the other hand, I feel as though, you know, I mean, the Panthers were organized as a response to police violence in their day, and you know, this is a few days after North Charleston and Tulsa, and it just, I mean, that part of it hasn't really stopped.
It's so interesting about it. You know, one thing that was interesting about the Panthers was intellectually they saw issues before their time, whether it was sickle cell anemia or the roll of breakfast. But what they did first, Colin, as you just pointed out, in Oakland, was they filmed the cops and took pictures of the cops. And the cops went ballistic because Oakland had imported a Southern police force to deal with the new Southern dock workers very brutally. Mm. And I think that's what we're seeing today, Colin, you know, with the role of cameras by citizens to hold police accountable and the reaction against some police. I do believe that we've just had a reprise of that of that drama.
Alex, what were you going to say?
Well, you know, you're talking about this thing that's in the news lately about police, these shootings. And they talk about profiling comes into that. Mm-hmm. Now, it's happened to me. Mm-hmm. I remember two particular occasions where I know I was in Naugatuck with my wife, who was going down the street, and a car was coming the opposite direction. It was a police car. And I knew they were watching me for somebody. They were looking for an excuse to stop me. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be, it was probably my seatbelt. They weren't sure I had it on. I looked in my rearview mirror, and they turned around. And by that, I didn't have my seatbelt on, and I put it on, and they had no probable cause. But it happens, you know. It's and I drummed it into my son at the time when he's, you know, that listen, don't make an issue of it at the moment. Be polite. Ask permission when you're reaching for your driver's license. I've never been abused by the law before, or you know, it's never happened to me. Now, I know I've been profiled, but you know, you don't deal with it that time. If you're being mistreated, you deal with it at a later time. You get your lawyer, you go to the police station or whatever, but you don't say, what's your badge number? You know, and I've drummed that into my now 18-year-old grandson, too. So things are changing, but I think there's a lot of fear now. Mm-hmm. This recent incident in Oklahoma. It's in the media, it has this steady drumbeat and repeats things. So I think that can exacerbate problem the thing, too.
But, it seems as though, Sam, that 68, 69, 70, this is a time when, in 71, response was out in the streets. You know, people, I mean, we went through Ferguson, and that was something we really hadn't seen very much of in America in a long time. And I wonder if you sort of have any theories about the way we respond to things now. For the most part, it's not, you know, in the form of huge rallies. I mean, I don't know whether the internet took over this job and became the new way we communicate about this, but it must feel very different now. I mean, if Ferguson or if Eric Garner or if North Charleston had happened in the middle of 1970, I mean, that would have been just, you know, like really literally squirting gasoline on that fire.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that has occurred, and I can't explain exactly why, most of these events in our history and in the history of the world, these protests for change are started by young people. Not 100%, but it's usually the young people who are looking for change. And you look at other countries like France, where they overthrow governments, and South America and so on, and we think of what went on in the Middle East and Africa. But the I think young people today, and maybe it's because they know so much because of the internet, they're really afraid to go out and do something like that. So that when it does occur, it's usually because of an injustice, a real injustice. It isn't just that there's a group of people who think we ought to change this or change that. But the Ferguson events and some of the others we've been hearing about, there's cause here. And so finally, when there's cause, people do become precipitous and try to make a protest. But they're I don't know that it's going to happen again in our society.
Yeah, not that way, maybe. All right, we have to stop now. This has been a fabulous conversation, and I want to thank Sam and Paul and Alex and the Institute Library for letting us do it in this atmospheric setting. Thanks also to Sydney Laro and Katie Tolarski, the road crew, for this particular operation. And we'll be back tomorrow, as always, with a brand new show. Oh, yeah.